Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack. On This Week in Radio Tech, Tom Ray is giving us a tour of WWV. That's the station that's all time, all the time. You're going to like the show. Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, and Tom Ray are all here for This Week in Radio Tech next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 132, recorded June 6th, 2012. Time ticks and tar. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Telos System and the Telos Zip 1 IP audio codec. Check it out on the web at telos-systems.com. Hey there, it's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Very glad that you are along. You've tuned to the show where we talk about radio technology. And that's everything audio that happens in a radio station, that happens in professional broadcasting, sometimes in amateur broadcasting. And we try to keep a lot of folks entertained and a few folks employed, too. I'm Kirk Harnack, as I mentioned, the host of the show, and I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance. That's my full-time job. I'm also part owner of 8 radio stations. I own the part that doesn't make any money, and that's why I work for Telos. We also have with us our cast of usual suspects. Let's bring in, first of all, the best-dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm well, Kirk. And yourself?
All's I'm good? Awesome. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm president at CCS Music Cam, a manufacturer of IP codecs, both for video and audio, for disclosure purposes. And right now, we just had a passing shower in New York City and pouring rain and flooding in the streets. But other than that, all is well, I have to say.
And you're safely above ground level, I assume.
Yes, I came up out of the subway, and all is good. They do flood from time to time, but not today.
All right. Actually, I've been in the subway there when it was flooded and the power was off. That was no fun. Also from New York State, also from the Northeast, from the Hudson Valley of New York, let's hear it for Tom Ray. Hello, Tom.
Hey, greetings and salivations, Kirk. I'm VP Engineering of WR Radio, Buckley Broadcasting, and yes, we do have a very interesting show tonight, and I'm glad to be here.
And you're the star of the show, or WWV is, but you're going to give us the grand tour, I understand.
Yes, I am, and got some stories and got a lot of history on the place, too. We can impart some things people didn't know and didn't suspect.
And our other usual suspect, the fellow who actually adds a modicum of, Midwestern charm, wit, and understanding and wisdom. It's Chris Tarr from Muckwanago. Hey, Chris.
Hey, just like you asked, got the suit coat on.
You fooled me.
All right, yeah, hang on, because now that I've got you got a good look, right?
Okay, I have a good look.
All right. Good, because I gotta take it off now. So if you stick with me for just a second.
Oh, geez, please. Oh God. Oh my God.
Hey, it's a family show. It's a family show.
There, now we're set.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
There.
All right.
Well, I feel much better now. That's some of that Midwest charm and common sense there.
There's one tour out of the way. Let's move on to the main event.
There you go.
Okay, Chris.
It was funny how after episode 132, Chris Tarr was never seen again on the show.
Sorry, Chris.
See, I brought the whole thing to a complete halt. I am so proud of myself.
Pretty much.
That is fantastic.
Haven't you got a soda stream to go deal with or something?
You know, I get three other engineers that you can't ever keep them quiet. And I just did that. I just made all of you guys speechless.
The chat room's going nuts. I'm blind now. Oh, my eyes.
All it took was my red heart boxers. And you guys are just up in arms.
Chris, I was speechless because I had my head hanging over the garbage can and I had my mic muted. But anyway.
Hey, if that, again. Hey, if you laugh or you cringe, whatever, at least I got a response.
Okay. Well, this, I'm sure there'll be a show title in here somewhere.
So that's that's how the governor got his votes. Basic it was common sense.
You know, I have to apologize to Tom Ray now because I think everybody's done. So, you know, I know you have the big, you know, WWV tour done, but I think we probably just lost everybody after I got up and took off my coat. So,
well, Burke can't switch anymore. He's blind. Come on, Chris. Jeez.
There's no Braille on the keyboard.
What time did we lose control of the show?
Okay, my work here is done.
All right. Well,
I gotta take my mic and, you know, do the, you know, let's drop the mic. Tar out.
Did we have a show topic?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, go ahead. You know, don't let me.
The topic's been too brief, so we'll have to continue on.
Oh, jeez.
All right. Tom, I can't think of any proper segue here.
Yes, I can. Thanks for joining
us. Your time is up. time like the present.
Yes.
So, Tom, how you doing?
I'm doing well. And if you want, we can actually start with our topic for tonight. And I promise I won't stand up.
Okay. Well, Tom, some months ago, how long ago did you write an article for Radio World on this topic?
You know, actually, I pulled up the information today because I wanted to take a look and see how long ago it was, and to refresh my memory with some things. And actually, it was 4 years ago.
Oh, that long. Okay. Well, good.
Yeah. And well, it's actually interesting. you mentioned before we got on the stream here that, you know, if you showed up, they probably wouldn't let you in. And that's probably right, because they usually don't give tours. The way this whole thing started, my wife and I had a wedding to go out to out in Golden, Colorado. And easiest way to fly out of the Hudson Valley area here is to go to Stewart Airport and take U.S. Air. And U.S. Air goes from Stewart to Philadelphia, from Philadelphia to wherever you're going.
Yeah.
So, you know, went to the airport. And the night before packing and we're walking through the airport, and I'm sitting there going, you know, there's something big in Colorado I've always wanted to see, and I couldn't for the life of me think what it was. And all of a sudden it hit me, WWV. So I pulled out my laptop and I looked up WWV, and I sent a little note to the to the chief engineer and said, you know, gee, here's who I am. We're going to be out in the area. Do you have time for a quick tour? And we got over to Philadelphia, and I pulled out the laptop and found a message from him. And he said, well, we generally don't do that, and I really don't know, and blah, blah, blah. So I, you know, gee, I write for Radio World, and I'd like to put an article together, and here's who I am, and here's who I work for, and yada, 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 yada. So we get out to Colorado, and we get to the hotel, and I pull up the my email, and sure enough, there's a note from him, and he says, yeah, come on in, you know, tomorrow at this time, we can give you about 30 to 45 minutes. And I said, okay, a quick tour. And I told my wife, we got someplace to go. And she looked at me and said, we're going to a bleep radio station when we're on vacation.
Hey, and you know, we ought to preface this. Not everybody I'm listening to the podcast probably knows what radio station this is. And I don't even know how it got the call letters, but the call letters are WWV. And there's another one, and it's on several frequencies at the same time, I guess, with the same callers. And then there's another version of it that's on long wave, I suppose, and it's WWVB. And then I understand there's also one in Hawaii, WWVH. So this is a service of the U.S. federal government, and they transmit the time, what time it is, and they transmit it all the time.
Well, and they also are the U.S. frequency standard. So if you need to set your set your frequency counter, you can use any one of their stations to do so.
Because they're all extraordinarily accurate. Yeah.
Highly accurate.
All right. So, okay, with that, and I'm sure 90% of our audience probably knew exactly what WWV is, but if you've ever, you know, had a shortwave radio and you've tuned across 2.5, 5, 10, I don't know what all the frequencies, 15, 20, 25 megahertz.
Stops at 20.
Stops at 20. Stops. Okay. You've probably heard WWV. It wouldn't hurt if Burke would try to find some WWV sample audio for us so we can play a moment of that. There's got to be something like that on the web. But okay, Tom, now that I've interrupted you,
Go right
ahead. If not, Burke, if you've got a phone patch available, I can give you the phone number out there and you can actually pull it up. That's exactly what I said to my wife. I said, but this isn't just any radio station. It's WWV. And she's yet to let me forget the fact that I owe her one for this one. So we took a trip, taking a look at the map from Golden, Colorado. It's a straight shot up the highway up north to Fort Collins, and about 45 minutes, and we ended up going up there, and we ended up spending 3 hours. A couple of great guys. When I got there, it was funny. They had a whole bunch of Radio Worlds out with several articles that I had written on the front page, so they already knew who I was. And they got a big kick out of talking to somebody from a commercial radio station because they don't get much visitors and they kind of live in their own little world. And there's this whole big world out there. And the ironic thing is there's a directional AM broadcast station across the street from them. And they never talk to those guys. And Burke, it sounds like Burke got some audio here.
U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock at the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 20 hours, 48 minutes, 15 seconds.
Yeah, it's me. It's Chris.
There you go.
thanks, Chris.
Yes, thanks, Chris. That's the audio, and or roughly the audio. And WWV, I'll give you some history on it. The call letters, like most stations in the United States, don't mean a thing. They were assigned by the Department of the Navy, and actually WWV, the call letters were assigned in October 1919. The station was established in May 1920, operating with 50 watts on 600 kilohertz. And the station on Friday night between 8:30 and 11 p.m. broadcast music concerts, of all things. And that was before KDKA signed on the air.
Wow, they played music on WWV.
Yep, for about 3.5 hours every Friday night.
Join us for WWV Music Party Night on Friday night.
Music time, 14 hours, 13 minutes.
You'll have a great time.
yeah.
But right. Then in 1920, they started assisting the Department of Agriculture. They were broadcasting market news and farm reports in Morse code on 750 kilohertz using a 2-kilowatt spark transmitter.
What would that have sounded like, a 2-kilowatt spark transmitter?
If you were in the transmitter room, probably really loud, bang, 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 bang. On the other end, if you were listening to it, you'd probably hear, they probably didn't have oscillators back then and VFO circuits in the radios. So you would have just heard spitting on the air.
Does a spark transmitter transmit on the frequency desired, or is it just all up and down the dial?
It transmits on the frequency desired and all over the band.
Well, yes. So, okay.
It would, of course, be most efficient on the frequency desired. In 1922, the government decided that WWV would be the standard frequency signal because you had all these things called radio stations coming on the air starting around 1922, and they needed a reference for their frequency. interesting to note, that back in those days, and where the heck did I find that here? Hang on, I just lost my spot. Back in 1922 and 1927, because in 1927 the crystal oscillator was invented, and that became the time standard at WWV. Mm-hmm. And before that, they were using a device called a wave meter. Now, I'm not sure exactly what a wave meter is, but there apparently was a national wave meter, and WWV was calibrated to it. And in 1928, you had to maintain your operating frequency of your broadcast station plus or minus 500 hertz of the assigned frequency. Today, it's 20 hertz for an AM station. So the standards have changed a little bit.
Yeah.
In 1933, they were on 5 megahertz with 30 kilowatts, and this was in College Park, Maryland. They were here on the East Coast. In June 1937, they started transmitting audio tones. A440 was one of the first things they transmitted, and of course, local piano tuners, and actually piano tuners all over the country, started using WWV to tune pianos.
Wow. Okay.
Let's see. In 1940, a fire destroyed the building in College Park, Maryland. But through an act of Congress, they allocated a whopping $230,000 and rebuilt the place. They were actually only off the air for about 5 days. They were able to salvage the frequency equipment and got back on the air with a kilowatt and then rebuilt the station for $230,000. You can't even think about pouring the foundation at most facilities. $230,000 these days.
It was a different time.
Ah, yes. And in, let's see, they stayed in that location until 1966, and they moved out to Fort Collins, Colorado. It doesn't say why. In 1944, they were ordered to synchronize their frequency standards to the U.S. Naval Observatory. And at that point in time, they were transmitting time announcements in code every 5 minutes, and the voice announcements started in 1950. And let's see, between 1955 and 58, WWV actually played a pivotal role in the definition of the second, because we did not have a definition of the second at that point. And they worked with the National Physics Laboratory in the in the UK and the U.S. Naval Observatory, and then they defined the second as, 9,192,631,770 cycles of the cesium atom. And that's the way the second is defined today. They started transmitting time code in 1961. They went on the air from Fort Collins December 1st, 1966. In 1972, they broadcast the first leap second in history. So that's one of their biggies. And up until this time with the voice recordings, they were using devices called mechanical drum recorders.
Okay.
And I've looked on the web. I have not been able to find a picture of one of these things. I'm guessing it's be something similar to like an Edison phonograph. I just don't know. But that voice you hear and the voice you heard when Chris played it before, there is a voice of WWV. The original voice was Don Elliott Held. When they moved out, I take that back, in 1991, excuse me, when they got rid of the mechanical drum recorders and they put digital playback in 1991 at WWV. That was actually around the time and actually just before the time broadcast stations started adopting digital playback. They changed to a voice. His name was John Doyle. And believe it or not, they had listener complaints.
Huh.
So, you know,
that new guy you got on the air. Can you go back to the old feller?
Exactly. I mean, you think you have problems at your station when you change air talent? Hey.
Yeah.
So they found a gentleman who sounded like Mr. Held. His name is Lee Rogers. That's the person you hear today.
I mean, really, that new guy, he doesn't give the time like the old feller did.
He's not as funny as the other guy.
He's a couple seconds shy of a minute.
Oh. He never answers the request line when I call.
And Mr. Tarr, what would you like to hear today? Oh, I'd like to hear 7 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the part of the timeline where they get caught. The Clear Channel comes in, buys them, moves them to Denver, puts them into a complex with a bunch of their other stations. What was that again? And, they change your legal ID to WWV for College Denver.
Stole my phone.
Let's see. Now, we have a couple other stations at this site. WWVB went on the air in 1956 as KK2XEI, which actually, if you look at that, it sounds like a ham call, but it's actually an illegal ham call. It's a government call. The station is still on the air today. It transmits on 60 kilohertz. Now, we're talking AM broadcast stations. In the case of WR, it's 710 kilohertz. FM stations, 100.5 megahertz. WWV transmits on 2.5, 5, 10, 15, and 20 megahertz. And this is 60 kilohertz, which is kind of hard to define because, yeah, it can be tuned like RF, but us broadcast engineers know 60 kilohertz as being part of the FM baseband composite audio signal. So it's technically audio, but it's being treated as RF here.
Sure.
Wow. And the reason they put that on was they started finding that the low frequency signal was a lot more stable for reception than the HF signals, and that makes a lot of sense because the 60 kilohertz signal hugs the ground. They don't know why there's a B on here, but they also, around the same time, had a station called WWVL, and that was on 20 kilohertz.
Oh my goodness!
So right at the top of the audio band.
Yeah.
That has since gone away. The antenna for that is now part of the array for WWVB, and we'll be seeing some of that shortly. Okay. It originally went on the air with 5 kilowatts from Fort Collins in 1963. They increased power to 7 kilowatts, 13 kilowatts in 1997. The power was increased to 25 kilowatts. When I visited in 2008, they were operating at 50 kilowatts effective radiated power, and we'll talk about that when we see the antenna. And they are now up to 50 kilowatts effective radiated power, and it's very interesting to see how they put this signal together because it's quite the facility, and especially with the antenna because it's nowhere near long enough for 60 kilohertz. But that's a brief history of WWV and WWVB. And actually, if Burke is ready, we can bring up the first picture. And that, of course, is proof that I was at WWV. They have two buildings on the facility. One building is the office, and in the back is WWVB, along with their generator. And the building a little lower down in the depression they're in is WWV. So we went inside, and if Burke can cue up the next shot. This is the WWV building, which contains all of the high-frequency transmitters. And if you also notice, there are a couple of satellite dishes out front, because when they say coordinated universal time, they really mean coordinated universal time. Not only does the National Bureau of Standards talk to other time standard, you know, other countries and make sure all their time standards are locked in, but WWV deals with other time standards around the country, such as in Japan or over in Great Britain, and they use satellite signals. And if you've dealt with satellite before, the first thing you're going to say is, well, wait a minute, you know, that bird's an awful long way up. Why? There's a delay there. Why would you do that? Well, you can measure that delay. You know how long the up to down time is. And then you can actually compare your signals, and that's what they do. They actually measure the signals, they measure the time difference between them, and they determine how close each one is. So they do a lot of work like this over there. So they don't just broadcast the time. They've got about 390 acres. It's pretty flat land out there. You know, that building we just saw is down in a little bit of a depression. And let's see, if we bring up the next picture, Burke, if you've got it. This is the these are the HF antennas. On the left side of the picture is the 20 megahertz antenna, followed by 15, 10, 5, and over towards the right hand side of the picture is the 2.5 meg antenna. Now, Burke, actually, if you can pan left a little bit, we see something very interesting. No, you had it right. Go no, other side. There we go. These antennas are vertical antennas. They're actually vertical dipoles. They're full dipoles at their chosen frequencies. And if you take a look dead center there, you see a couple of black lumps in the middle of the tower. That's an insulator.
Yeah.
Because the top of the tower is hot. The bottom is at ground. And the transmission line actually runs up halfway up the tower, and the center conductor connects to the upper section, and the shield connects to the lower section.
Is this Tom or anybody else know? Is this what they call a Franklin antenna, or is that something else?
No, that's something else. This is just a vertical dipole. Antenna actually has two sections that are phased.
Oh,
one on top of the other, and actually it's pretty close to a full wave antenna, but these antennas are half wave.
Okay.
Now, Burke, if you can bring up the other one, this is a picture of the 2.5 megahertz antenna, which is long enough, or tall enough, actually, to require aviation lighting. It's just about 200 feet. And of course, if you look halfway up, you see that black bump, and that's an insulator. But it gets even more interesting, Burke, if you could bring up the next shot, because I have a close-up of the next shot. Not only do you see the insulator, but you see an Austin Ring transformer hanging in midair.
Well, it's, yeah, it's attached to the tower, but it's just, it's way up there.
Yeah, it's about 100 feet up the tower at the insulation point, because with AM signals, or actually with a hot tower, because don't forget, the top of this tower is hot.
Yeah,
they have to light it, and you have to decouple. You have to separate the RF from the AC. They don't get along very well together. On an AM tower like a WOR or Chris Tarr may have a few. I know that Chris Tobin had a couple. You usually have the Austin Ring transformer at the bottom of the tower because we feed the tower from the bottom. Right. In this case, they feed the tower from the middle, and they had to decouple it somehow. One way is to put an RF choke in a box and decouple it that way. This is, in my mind, is actually the easiest way, because if something goes wrong with this, you're going to see it, and a tower climber is going to have an easy time replacing it, where if you had a choke in a box, the guy's got to go up. These guys don't deal with electricity normally. They hook up tower lights, and that's about it. So this would be real easy for somebody to fix, but they had to isolate the AC from the RF. And that's how they did it. They stuck a Austin Ring in midair. Now, these Austin Rings, too, are not light. Those things weigh, each of those rings weighs about 500 pounds.
That much?
Yeah. You've never encountered an Austin Ring on the ground?
I have, but I could pick it up myself. So I'm sure it didn't weigh 500 pounds, at least not the one I have.
But it must have been a smaller one. The bigger ones weigh about 500 pounds.
Wow.
If Bert could show that picture again of the Austin Rings, this is, me, I'm always wanting to explore the teachable moments here. Bert, if there's any chance you could zoom in on that a bit more. So
That's a great thing there. There you go.
Yeah, that's a great picture. So what's happening here is there's AC power coming from the ground, coming from where the land is, where the tower, sits on the ground. And the idea here is they have to get AC power, 110 volt or 240 volt, whatever it is, 240, 241, up the tower to light the lights. And we have this problem because there's this insulator in the middle of the tower because of the way the tower is fed. And so we have to, if we just put a piece of conduit across the insulator, we would just negate the benefit or the effect of having the insulator there, which is necessary in order to feed this dipole from the middle. So we've got to figure out a way to make AC power go across that insulator without the RF knowing anything about it. So those Austin rings are pretty much invisible to the RF. And you notice those Austin rings are not touching each other. They're basically a transformer with an air dielectric between the primary side and the secondary side. Now, I don't know how they make those things. It's two rings that are intertwined, like a puzzle at Cracker Barrel, right? Some of you know what I'm talking about. How do I get these things apart? And each, the primary side is wound and wound with many turns of wire, and the secondary side is wound with some equal number of turns of wire if it's a one-to-one transformer. And you put, 110 or 240 volts or whatever it is on one side, and you get that on the other side, and the two sides don't physically touch each other. There are some inches of air separation between one ring and the other ring. And that is how you do it.
Mm-hmm. It's not pretty if those two rings touch. We have one of our Buckley stations. We had a Austin ring at the bottom of it, and the mount collapsed last year, and the two rings touched. Blew a hole through the ring, and that was only 1,000 watts.
Oh, man.
Was not pretty.
Well, Tom, thanks for letting me take a moment to explain the theory of the Austin ring. Was it invented by somebody named Austin? Is that how they're named?
Actually, it's the Austin Transformer. The Austin Transformer or Austin Insulator Company, and they're made in Canada.
Ah, that's okay.
Because they also make insulators. They make the transformers, and those transformers actually come in numerous sizes, so.
Hmm. I said somebody in the chat room just made me think about what I said. Air is a dielectric. Well, I guess it's not. It's dielectric. Does that really fit the definition of a dielectric? It's these two halves of a transformer with air between them. So
anyway, I'm not sure you call it a dielectric ground. But anyway, the primary and the secondary don't touch. They're not wrapped around a common frame of steel plates, as is usually the case with a transformer. But I don't know how efficient an Austin ring is. Is it close to 100% efficient, or is it really low?
You know, that's a good question. I've never investigated, but I don't think it's really low. I think it's up there.
Okay. So the secondary ring captures most of the electromagnetic field of the primary ring and couples it on, Turns it back into AC power, and off you go. Well, that's pretty cool.
And that way you don't put RF into the power line, so the power company stays happy, and you don't have the power line trying to do anything with the RF signal, so the RF signal stays happy, and that way everybody's happy, and you're on the air, and life is good. You just go about your business.
Tom, one more question about these dipole antennas. You said they're vertical dipoles. Mm-hmm. So when they're fed, are they fed with some kind of a balanced line arrangement?
No, actually, they feed it with coax.
Coax?
And they take the coax runs up the tower, and they take it and they tie the center conductor of the coax to the upper part of the tower, and they tie the shield or the outer part of the coax right to the bottom of the tower, and that's it. They don't even have a tuning point over there. Now, I didn't ask them, and I'm not sure. This actually may be 75 ohm coax, because a true dipole is about 72 ohms. It's not 50 ohms. Okay. So.
And so I take it they don't phase the upper and lower at all. It's just, they're just fed equally. But they'd be out of phase with each other naturally, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, you've got one ground, you've got one that's hot, and off it goes, and the signal launches itself, and you hopefully pick it up someplace and listen to it.
Now, most of it, you know, all of us here on the show are broadcast engineers. We tend to deal with AM frequency stuff and FM frequency stuff, and occasionally higher. So these towers are a lot shorter than I was really thinking about. It may make sense. I mean, if they're the frequencies that they are, they're a grand total of what, a half wave at the given frequency.
Right. So at 20 megahertz, say you're talking, it's about 40 feet tall.
Yeah. So in AM broadcast, we deal with towers that are tend to be much taller than that, anywhere from 120 feet or so at a minimum. Up to 400-600 feet tall for an AM station on the low part of the dial. So, yeah, it really hadn't crossed my mind that these things are in the, well, I know they're in the short wave frequencies, but the implications are that the towers are short.
There you go. And it's funny to see them because they're all lined up and it's like bink, 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 bink.
Okay. Listen, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sidebar much, but that's pretty fascinating.
Burke, if you could just bring up the next shot. The next shot, we actually went inside. And inside, they have this room, and there's me checking the time on my watch. I was 20 seconds. Hey, you're at a time place. You got to do it, right? I was actually 20 seconds fast. This is a screened room. When you're in this room, the transmitters are right outside. There is no RF. I mean, it's copper all around. There's copper under the floor tile. There's copper all up the wall. All copper sheet, copper ceiling, copper door, finger stock on the door. When that door is closed, it's pretty much RF tight. And what you're looking at there in the racks, this is the WWV set of racks. You've got, you'll notice that right behind me, and then two more in a row, there's primary, secondary, and tertiary. Those are the actual time code generators. Okay. Right there. You'll notice there's a compeller in the rack. That's the audio processing.
I say, but Marvin Caesar must be proud.
Oh, he should be. And if, Burke, if you pan up a little bit, right there, you're looking at the primary, secondary, and tertiary digital playback units.
Oh, this has the guy's voice.
Yep. These are they're made by Raycom. And they're all programmed identically. The interesting thing about this facility, they don't have like a Burke remote control. They don't have a Sign Systems remote control or any other brand of remote control that might be out there. They built their own. It's based on Z80 microprocessors. It dials their pagers or cell phones. It tells them when something's up. It monitors the time code. If it sees the time code go away, it'll switch to a different time code generator. If they see all of a sudden there's no voice announcement, it'll pop over to an alternate voice or digital playback unit, and then tell the guys there's something wrong. You ought to come look at it.
Now, so, there's four racks there. Is four racks all it takes to have the most accurate clock in the world? I mean, that would fit in my office, it looks like.
Actually, that's not the clock there. That is the interface equipment.
Okay. All right.
You know, very much like at your broadcast station, you'd have a rack with the satellite receivers and a rack with the audio processing and a rack with, you know, probably the Axia equipment if you're running an Axia system. And that's basically what this is. So when it leaves this room, Burke, if we could, if you could do the honors with the next one, we go into a big hallway that's actually horseshoe shaped, and here we have the WWV transmitters all lined up in a row.
Okay.
2.5 megahertz, 5 meg, 10, 15, and 20. The 2.5 meg and the 20 meg transmitters run at 2.5 kilowatts each. The 5, 10, and 15 run at 10 kilowatts each. What we're looking at there, that 5 megahertz transmitter, that is, that's the backup transmitter for the 5 megahertz frequency of WWV. And I thought they were made by a company called Brown Boveri, and I was incorrect on that. They are made, and I am looking for that right now, by, where the heck is it? It's on
these, while you're looking that up, these transmitters are all fed identical audio, right? The same audio from the... Goes to all the transmitters.
They're made by the Technical Materiel Corporation, TMC. They're TMC transmitters for the backups.
Oh, okay.
And if Burke brings up the next one, we will see the 5 megahertz primary transmitter, and it's going to look fairly familiar.
Oh, my goodness. It's a CCA. And it looks like is that the G series?
I believe it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got the meters down there at waist level on the left-hand cabinet.
Actually, oh my god, it's a CCA, and it's on, and it's working?
Hey, now, come on!
Well, you know, it's funny. I said to the guys, I said, you know, CCA's out of business. I said, you planning on replacing transmitters? They said, no. I said, well, what are you going to do if it breaks, if there's a part you can't get? I don't have a picture of it, but they took me into their workshop, which is about as big as my house. You could eat off the floor, and they just say, well, we'll make the part.
Yeah. Yeah.
they'll make the part. It's like, hello.
Yeah.
These guys are incredible. They really, really are. But these are, they're kind of hot rotted, CCAs. Of course, they're modified for the frequencies, and they made some modifications in the modulator stages. And these transmitters themselves, they're not really modulated heavily. The tones are about 50%. The ticks you hear, and I've got a picture coming up shortly that defines the how things are made. You can actually make the ticks on a digital audio editor. And the voice modulation is only about 75%. I mean, they rarely approach 100% with these things. So they're kind of breezing along. They're... Yeah. But honest to God, this place, you could eat off the floor. The place is spotless. The transmitters, even the older ones, are spotless. And these are all, believe it or not, these are all Navy surplus transmitters.
Oh.
They were in service at various naval facilities around the world. And when the Navy gets tired of them, they show up at WWV.
Huh. Interesting.
In a very timely fashion.
Hey, guys, we're going to take a quick break here, Tom. If you can hold your thought for right after our commercial announcement, we ought to give some credit to the folks who are making our show possible financially. And yes, they're lining our pockets. So we're going to take a break for a second here and hear from the folks at Telos. And lately, I've been working with the developers of the Zip One, and we've been finalizing some new software for the Zip One. Burke, if you can possibly head over to the page for the Zip One. This is at the Telos website, telos-systems.com, and click on the Zip One. This is an IP audio codec. It works. It's designed to work over the public internet. It doesn't have to have a tightly controlled network or a QoS-enabled network. The whole idea here, using some sophisticated software from Fraunhofer in Germany, we're able to get really reliable audio over an internet connection that can occasionally be jittery, can drop packets,
and have other, you know, problems like that, different latencies, packets arriving at different times. And the Zip One is very good about putting these packets, putting the packet stream back together and giving you some really good audio. Now, the Zip One is a stereo audio codec. You put stereo in one end, you get stereo out the other end. It's bidirectional, so it's got send and receive. You know, the audio inputs can handle professional line level, but they can also handle a mic level. So if you want to take a dynamic mic and plug it straight into the back XLR connectors, you certainly can. If you want to use a condenser mic, you can turn on phantom power and use a condenser mic with the Zip One. There's also a new video that's right there on the webpage. I actually recorded this video just last week. It's a quick start about how to get the Zip One going on your network. Yes, there's me. Okay, there you go. That's me talking about the Zip One and how to hook it up. And just to make sure that this video was accurate, and also that the directions that I wrote a 4-page document with a quick start was accurate. I actually got my 16-year-old daughter, Madeline, down here to the office. Yes, I pulled her away from the television on her summer vacation. I said, Madeline, read these directions. Or if you want to, you can watch the video. The video is like 13 minutes long. The directions are just 4 pages long. So I said, read these directions and make this thing work. And so I factory reset it to zero, you know, to like a factory, like just out of the box. And literally after about 80 seconds of boot up, a minute and a half later, Madeline had this thing making its first IP codec call across the public internet, hooked to my network here at the house. Very little configuration just to get it going. Of course, it has lots of options. If you need to set port numbers, if you need to give it, you know, fixed IP addresses, if you need it to make or receive SIP phone calls, it'll do that. So it's very flexible, very powerful. It's not expensive. It should be well under $2,000 in most places around the world. Check it out on the TELUS website, the Zip One IP audio codec. It's easy to use. Works really well. Check it out. Thanks to TELUS for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. There you go. All right, Tom, let's continue on with your tour of WWV. Go ahead, sir.
Well, now we're going to come to the guts here. Burke, if you could do the honors, please. These are the, eventually, we'll have the frequency standards here. When you see it, you're going to say, that's a, you know, that's a cesium clock. Pan down just a little bit, Burke. Yeah, that's the comparator system. Burke, if you could pan down a little bit, we'll see the actual cesium clock. They have 5 of them here.
Is finding the
there we go.
There we go.
That's the cesium clock. Looks like a personal computer. Doesn't look like much. They take these a couple at a time, about once a year. They put them in the car. They take them down to the U.S. Master Clock in Boulder, make sure they're happy, bring them back. By using 5 clocks through that elaborate comparator system you saw up top, it takes a look at all these clocks, and they are within 2 nanoseconds.
Is that good?
When they transmit the time. Well, hell of a lot more accurate than my watch, that's for sure. but
2 nanoseconds. Is that good enough for government work?
and this is also in its own room. And the interesting thing is, I was talking to the guys, and they said, you know, I said, is this like a nuclear reactor? I mean, does the cesium go bad? And they said, yeah, about every 5 to 7 years, they have to change the cesium in it because the cesium the time will start drifting.
Oh my goodness.
Huh. So anything more than about a 5 nanosecond drift, time to change the cesium.
So where do you go to get new cesium? Down at the cesium store?
Yeah, it's right around the corner next to Radio Shack. No,
they've got a 7-Eleven on the corner. They just stop by, get themselves a big gulp and some cesium.
Yeah, that guy, Ahmadinejad's got some for you.
Unless you're in New York City, you can't get the big gulp. But anyway.
I have to comment here real quick. Swamp Rat. They're in trouble when that thing starts flashing 12 o'clock.
What if they get the cesium from an unreliable source? Oh, yeah, this is fresh cesium. Yeah, it's absolutely fresh.
Well, you know, the scary thing is they know where all the 13-year-old kids are in the neighborhood, so they can reset it if it starts flashing 12.
Yeah.
Burke, if you could bring up the next one. This is the actual, the actual time clock. This in broadcast, we would call this a format clock. This is how WWV is set up for the time code. It shows you how the actual time code is constructed. It's just ones and dashes. That shows you, you know, it starts with units of the year, then the minutes, then the hours, then the days. The interesting thing at this facility, the master clock doesn't know daylight savings time is coming up. So the on Sunday of the, or no, it's Saturday night, sometime Saturday, the silly human goes in and pushes a switch that says, okay, tonight at 0000 UTC, it's time to say that we're on daylight savings time, or daylight savings time has gone away.
So, Tom, these pulses that are sent, it look to me like from that graph, from that diagram, that mm-hmm. these pulses are, it takes a whole minute to send the whole yes. string.
Yep, it takes 60 seconds.
Okay. Okay.
To send the code. And actually, Burke, if you could bring up the next one, we'll see where these live. Because these aren't the ticks you hear. These aren't the clock ticks.
Oh.
They live on a 100 hertz subcarrier that is modulated like Morse code.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So all the voice is going on around it. And this little 100 hertz subcarrier is sitting there, and that's what the radio listens to, and that's where it pulls out the time code. But yes, it does take a full 60 seconds for the entire code to go by. Okay. So
now this is a clock of the whole hour. The previous diagram was the breakout for a minute, and right. each of those minutes is contained 60 times in that pie chart format clock right there. And so if you listen, so the it looks like the BCD time code is on all the time, right?
Yes, the BCD time code is there. And actually, what I was saying about you could generate the ticks by yourself, if you take a look over towards the right-hand side, it says the beginning of each hour. Well, wait a minute. No, where does it say it? No, it doesn't say it on here. What I've got to do is I've got to find it. But you can actually the ticks are 1,000 hertz. They don't sound like it, but they are. And it's something like 8 cycles of 1,000 hertz.
Ah, that's
and that produces like a tick. Yeah. Tick, and that's what generates the tick. But we'll move along. Burke, if you could move to the next one. We're going to take a look now at WWVB. This is the long wave transmitter.
The 60 hertz.
The 60 kilohertz.
Oh, 60 kilohertz. Sorry, 60 kilohertz. Yep. Sure.
They actually have three. These are two of the transmitters. They actually have three, so they have a standby. Each of these transmitters will produce 50 kilowatts. There's no voice modulation on WWVB. It's strictly... for all intents and purposes, a Morse code signal.
Okay. All right.
A digital zero is identified as 0 dB, or in this case, 50 kilowatts. A digital one is identified as 17 dB below carrier. So if you were to watch an oscilloscope and they have an oscilloscope there, you see carrier.
Oh, okay.
And that's actually what this wristwatch listens to, and usually if you have something that says it's an atomic clock and hanging on the wall, it's listening to WWVB.
Ah, it's okay, the 60 kilohertz signal. All right.
Now, both of these transmitters are operating at the same time. One feeds one antenna, one feeds the other antenna.
Yeah.
In phase, so they're actually running a two-tower directional antenna, which gives a pattern that's somewhat east-southeast from Denver, Colorado.
So what parts of the U.S., the continental U.S., for example, would not be covered as well because of that directional pattern?
They tend to have some trouble up in the Northwest, Oregon and Washington, but they cover the East Coast pretty well. They cover the South pretty well. They cover just about everything except occasionally they have trouble in the, like I said, behind the antenna, which is Oregon and Washington. And sometimes, you know, if we have a storm moving through here on the East Coast, yeah, my watch might not set during a lot of thunder and lightning, which makes sense because once again on WWVB. It takes a full minute for that code to go by. So this watch has to receive a full minute of code before it says, yeah, I know where I am.
Do these stations ever have the problem of, say, a class 4 AM? Well, I live 4 miles from the tower site, and I can never pick them up.
Oh, especially on the HF side, because with the atmosphere, atmospheric disturbances and everything else, I mean, there are times they have a monitoring receiver in, I think it's Boulder. They have a monitoring receiver in Boulder, Colorado, and I was looking at it last night, and it's a status, and it's monitoring receiver Boulder. Couldn't hear the 10 megahertz signal. Maryland had a 3 out of 4.
Yeah, I remember when I was a little kid, you know, it's what got me into radio, was sitting there with my transistor radio listening to WWVB at night, you know, next to my pillow, and I knew I wanted to be in radio. You actually answered my question with that, with the clocks on the wall. The other thing I do notice is that a lot of these clocks, obviously for propagation purposes, a lot of these wall clocks that set their time to that signal do so at night. That's usually when these clocks are kind of programmed to try to listen for the signal, when everything's kind of, at least in the houses and things like that, everything's pretty quiet.
Right, exactly. And I'm typing a note to Burke here. Because of course that's when the atmospheric disturbances will be a little less. You don't have anybody running the microwave, running the washing machine, doing whatever in the house. Everything's fairly quiet. So yes, all these clocks do look at for the signal at night, but they are on 24/7. Burke, if you could bring up the next one. Burke was telling me we've only got about 10 minutes here, so we're going to run through this fairly quickly. And he's writing a note to me right now, so when he brings up the next picture. This is the time code room for WWVB. You'll notice that there are no digital voice announcers in here. But once again, they have a main, a backup, and a tertiary for the time code generators. And an oscilloscope over there for taking a peek at the actual envelope coming out of the transmitter. So they can tell that they're actually modulating.
Hmm.
So that's their confidence monitor.
The all-important flashlight over there by the on the filing card cabinets.
Well, you know, it's funny. I asked these guys, here you have a long-wave transmitter. I said, what's your biggest problem? I expected them to say ice. I expected them to say lightning. I expected them to talk about the antenna system or some natural phenomenon, and they said, the power company. Just like us.
Just like us, the power company.
The power company causes, they said the power company out there causes them more grief than it's worth. But they do have a generator on site, so they're back on, you know, fairly quickly. Burke, if you could bring up the next shot. This is, it's a little difficult to see, but this is the, or one of the arrays for one of the antennas. And they actually have 4 or 5 towers that have wires that come down to a center, and then they have a drop wire. So the top wires form what's called a capacitance hat, which has the tendency to, or it makes the actual antenna, which is the drop wire, look longer than it is. And the drop wire itself is only 400 feet long. And if you actually took a look and figured out how long a wave is at 60 kilohertz, it's 5,000 meters, which is 4,100 feet. That's almost that's close to a mile. My mile is about 5,200 feet. So this is a short antenna, and what they're doing to get an equivalent 70,000 watts out of the front lobe of that antenna, they actually put about 100,000 watts into it. That's how inefficient this antenna is. Burke, if you could bring up the next one.
Colorado.
What's really cool is this is what they call it, the Helix House. We would call it a tuning house for the bottom of the tower. At the top, you see that wire going up, which is, that's the antenna, okay. and a big mother insulator. Yeah. Burke, if we could now go inside the house, that's the next one. This is a solid metal building. Inside, it's copper sheet, and it's actually quite interesting because you see that wire coming down to this coil. That coil is called a variometer, and we have a close-up of it coming up. I actually calculated that the impedance at that point where that white wire is coming down is about between 0.4 and 0.5 ohms.
Oh, man. Okay.
So at the time, they were putting 38 kilowatts of RF into this. That means that wire, that white wire, is carrying 300 amps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. And of course, they have a fence in front of this thing. They wouldn't let me near it, and they were saying, "Oh, gee, you know, RF radiation." And I looked at them and said, "No, that's not what you're afraid of. It's a 300 amps. That's going to be a hell of a lot of voltage." They said, "You're afraid it's going to arc over." They said, "Yeah, we don't need you lighting up." I said, "Thanks." So, Burke, if you can go to the next shot in sequence there, which I believe is the close up of the variometer. I should have written down what these are. Yeah, there it is.
Why do they call it a variometer? That's a new word for most broadcast engineers, including me.
I don't know, but the way this thing works is there's another coil inside that, and this is all actually computer monitored, and it takes a look at the SWR on the transmission line, and it moves that internal coil in and out along with what, you know, whatever it needs to give it a 1-to-1 SWR. And that could be just because the wind blew and it changed it changed where the capacitance hat was. It could be ice on the antenna. It could be for whatever reason. Because when you're standing there at the building, you don't hear anything. There's no modulation. But what you hear is bzz, 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 as it's constantly shifting the position of this thing.
Okay. That's fine.
Now, Burke, if you could change the next shot. At the other end of the transmission line, it actually looks fairly normal if we take a look at that picture, because they just have a couple of vacuum caps and a little coil, and that's it. That's the that interfaces the transmission line. That's the black thing you see there in the background.
Okay.
And you got a couple of loading coils, and you've got there's a couple of capacitors. Actually, there's a couple of vacuum caps in this cylinder here. And it looks like a mica capacitor over on the little red stand. Okay, Burke, if you could bring the next one out.
So this is all the tuning network, and then there's a motorized part of it that's computer controlled moment by moment to keep the
SWR exactly where it belongs. And Burke, if you could bring up the next guy once he is. This is the time code, which looks very similar to that on WWV. There are slight variations. I can't tell you off the top unless I put them side by side. I can't tell you what they are, but it's the same thing. And it takes a full minute to send this time code, hours, you know, minutes, hours, days, and the year and the daylight savings time and leap second, if they're going to do a leap second.
Now, just make sure that on this WWVB, there is no voice audio. It's only this digital modulation time code.
Right. It's only time code modulation. So it's just digital ones and digital zeros as defined by the carrier level of the transmitter.
Gotcha.
And Burke, if you could bring up the next guy here. If I'm not mistaken, if I'm in the right place, this should be a close-up of that variometer. A good close-up of the variometer. If not, it may be something else because there's only a couple of pictures to go. But this, you know, this was quite the trip. And it was funny because I know someone who worked for the AM station across the street. And they actually had to go and knock on WWV's door one day because they had a detuning problem and they wanted to make sure they were detuned properly for the HF stations. Hey, Burke, do we have another shot you can bring up here before we come to a close? Maybe not, but anyway, don't quite know what we had there, but anyway, that was that's the tour. Nope. There's another one after this, I believe. Nope. That's it.
Okay.
We'll call it good for now. But that's the tour of WWV and WWVB. It's a very, very interesting facility. Like I said, my wife and I spent 3 hours there. She had no idea what we were talking about, but we were talking radio and having a great old time with the guys.
So, Tom, were the engineers at WWV anything like your co-hosts here on the show or other broadcast engineers, you know, or did they have a really different skill set?
They had kind of a different skill set because they were one guy was he was an EE, and the other guy was more of the hands-on guy. And I mean, they're very nice guys. And it was very funny because I said to them, I took a look at the antenna for WWVB, which is two towers fed in phase. It's about 0.17 wavelengths, which actually is about a quarter mile apart. And I said, directional antenna. I says, what's the phasing like between these two? And they looked at me and went, huh? And so I pointed to the directional AM across the street. I said, yeah, let me tell you how that works. and they actually learned from me. I learned from them, and they got a kick because they never get out of their little world there, you know, because they're in more of a scientific environment where that has to stay on the air. But, you know, if one of the transmitters drops off, it's not critical like in our world where you're losing money, you're losing audience, you're not fully serving the public. They've got all these frequencies where they can serve the public. So, it was interesting for them, and it was interesting for me to see how they do it.
You know what? You have a WOR, and Chris Tobin had it at his stations at CBS when he was there, and Chris Tarr has it at his intercom stations, but it's missing from WWV. There's no Arbitron PPM encoders.
Not yet, but, you know, God knows. They come in number one in morning drive. You know, there's a big problem with your station.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, we got to vamoose out of here real quick. Tom, that was absolutely fascinating. Chris Tarr, you got any last-minute questions, any quick comments for us?
No, I mean, I could stand up if you'd like. And
not oh, God. We already did that one. Thank you.
All right. I take it that's
I'm
it.
Just that,
that's
ready to wrap her up.
Good deal. Chris Tobin, do you get any last-minute questions or comments for Tom?
No. He answered all the questions. I just, it was great. It's, if you read some of the stuff that the Naval Observatory does, it's amazing. It's more than just time. It's a lot of wild stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. They do some really neat things. They really do.
All right. Tom, Chris, thank you so much for being here on the show. Tom, I appreciate your effort in putting the show together. I know you wrote something for Radio World about 4 years ago, so thanks for presenting it all to us. We got to say a quick goodbye and good night and get out of here. Our show today was brought to you by Telos Systems and the Telos Zip 1 IP audio codec. Coming up on a future show, we've got an engineer from another 50-kilowatt station. We're going to have Jason Cooper from WSM here in Nashville, where I live. They've got one of the original Blaw Knox towers. It's a huge, huge monstrosity, just about 4 miles down the road from where I live. Pretty cool. And he's going to talk about the big flood that we had here in Nashville and how they kept the station on the air. Just all the stuff they had to go through to keep it on the air and then move it finally back to the Opryland Hotel. That's Jason Cooper coming up on in the next week or two here on This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tarr from Mukwonago, Wisconsin, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
And Chris Tobin from New York City, thanks for being with us as well.
Have a great night. And wherever you are, Ms. Calabash, have a good evening.
And a big round of applause for Tom Ray. Tom, thanks for bringing us the WWV story. Appreciate that.
Well, it was my pleasure, Kirk, and always a lot of fun, and see you guys next week.
Okay, take care. We'll see you next time, next week, on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.